Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Caribbean Studies. I'm Alejandra Bronfman. My guest today is Vincent Juice. He's the author of Urban Dwellings, Haitian Citizenships, Housing, Memory, and Daily Life in Haiti, published in 2022 by Rutgers University Press. This book thinks about housing as a way to understand many things about everyday life for Haitians. It's about the ways the built environment shapes relationships and well-being. In this interview, we talk about the idea of dwelling, the research process, and the ways that people in Haiti create meaningful lives as they confront adversity. Here's our conversation. Vincent, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you on the program. As a way to begin, can you tell us about how you came to this particular set of questions surrounding citizenship and the built environment in Haiti?
For the book is actually coming from me settling in Mississippi with my wife in 2004. We worked in Louisiana and started to inquire about the history of the place where we're in, especially Natchez, Mississippi. Where you have a lot of antebellum houses, plantation houses, but also in a built environment, a lot of shotgun houses and smaller vernacular houses. And I was very intrigued, not by the plantation houses, but mainly by the smaller kinds that you would find along the Mississippi River. So coming from France, also in Louisiana, I was intrigued by the history of an ancient French colony in Natchez, Mississippi. The native populations were wiped out by the French in the 18th century. There was a violent history of slavery, of slave trading also in that region, where the French were highly influential. And when you start digging about the history of the built environment and of food and of language in Louisiana, all the paths lead back to Haiti. Because, for instance, in 1809, more than 10,000 refugees from Saint-Domingue, Haitian people, settled in New Orleans and brought with them, of course, their culture and their architecture and their music. So that's how I started to think about Haiti, especially because I had a strange notion of Haiti. I could not visualize what was there. And when the earthquake in 2010 happened, I became even more intrigued. So I went there in 2012 to mainly look at the vernacular buildings that were still standing, the old houses. And what I noticed is that my interest also for houses was more an interest of what people were doing with houses. It was not just about the built environment and the history of the houses, but many of the people who used and dwell in those houses. And talking with people, you quickly realize that what we call a house in Haiti or a household is not just a shelter or a material feature, but there is a whole set of social infrastructures that are very important at the neighborhood level, at the family level, that is woven around those houses. So I guess that this question of citizenship and of belonging came when I was inquiring about the history of houses. And when talking about the houses, people talk not just about the walls around themselves, but they talk mainly about themselves, about the country, about what they did for a living and how these houses were part of their own lives.
So the word dwellings, which is part of the title, runs through the book as a foundational way of understanding a set of practices and spaces. What does dwelling mean to you? And more importantly, really, what does it mean to the people in the book?
Yes. So when I was there for the first time in 2012, what happened, people were living in 10 camps. You also had USAID, for instance, and other big organizations that were offering very expensive temporary shelters. These shelters looked like houses, but they were made either of plywood or plastic, and they were not suited for the climate at all. Plus, like Max Schuller showed in his book, Humanitarian Aftershocks, he has a very good analysis of that phenomenon of the temporary shelters. It displaces people from their neighborhoods. So when we talk about the reconstruction of Port-au-Prince, I was there 2 years, a year and a half after the earthquake. What really surprised me is that Port-au-Prince, the inner city, has never been rebuilt, even to this day, and that people were displaced in shelters, and a shelter is not a dwelling. So again, when I talked with people who were displaced by the earthquake and living in dire conditions in those temporary shelters, almost everyone told me that the money that was spent on those temporary shelters could have helped them to relocate in their former neighborhoods and to be with their network of friends and with family members. So the idea of dwelling is very different from the idea of finding a shelter. When we talk about houses, it's not just, you know, having a roof over your head. What people were talking about mainly was the type of socialities also that came with living in downtown Port-au-Prince. It comes also with memories. So this is the idea of creating a home. But in Haiti, like I describe in the book, what is very important with houses and what I think I call dwelling is also taking outside of the house. It's surrounding the house. It's all those small-scale economies that are built in these domestic settings. So it's simply talking, you know, with people and seeing that you cannot cater to a housing crisis by coming from the United States with materials from Home Depot or whatever and building shelters in random places, but place matter. And like I show in a book with the story of my friend Clomène Firmin, even though her house was destroyed, she would come back to these neighborhoods to conduct her business and to try to rebuild her dwelling over there. So what was important for her was, again, the network of friends, a network of solidarity that was there. So in a way, thinking about the earthquake and the post-disaster landscape and belonging at the same time, how Haitians should have been included in the reconstruction of the country, they were not at all. This idea of dwelling became very important, meaning thinking about houses that are culturally sound and where people can rebuild their lives as they see fit.
The book is really open about your research process, which I really enjoyed. So what was your research process? How did you get people to trust you? How did you realize who to talk to, who was available, who wasn't?
Yes, that's a good question. It's always tricky. I guess what I don't see in the book is that many people close their doors or refuse to talk with me at times. So it's not very easy, and it's kind of a strange job also too, sometimes, you know, you knock at the door of a house that you find interesting and you ask questions about architecture and who lived there and what is happening. It's not always easy. My research process, I guess, is very collaborative. So I had a good chance of working with anthropologist Laura Wagner, who was already in Haiti since 2008. She introduced me to her network of friends, and I guess you can call it the snowball effect, that through Laura's network, I met also friends of her friends. So the first time that I was in Port-au-Prince in 2012, I'm really grateful for what Laura did. She sort of kickstarted my research. And then, of course, I came back for a longer time. So I spent about 12 months between 2013 and 2014 over there. And by then, I had already a good network of friends. But it was in 2013 that I met Alain Joseph, who's my main partner in the book, with whom I did quite a bit of fieldwork. So Alain is an art historian who works in several schools of the capital as an art history teacher. And we were both very interested by the history of the old houses of Port-au-Prince, especially that they stood in a city where most landmarks had collapsed. So the goal of Alain, because the houses that I'm talking about, whether they are big or small, even presently are being destroyed by people who are rebuilding new houses, or sometimes by the state that can bulldoze entire neighborhoods, we felt that it was urgent to photograph, to document the history of those houses. And I guess that working with Alain Joseph, to be introduced to his networks of friends created a good dynamic. We worked extensively together. He had his own project of doing a catalog of urban art history through photographs and text, and he's still working on that book. And he helped me with a few of my projects. So I think that this collaboration with Alain was key. And then, like many anthropologists, I guess, the fact that you are going back to the same places, the same little cafes or restaurants or public plazas, or I befriended booksellers. I'm a collector also of Caribbean music, so I entered groups of Caribbean, of Haitian men who were collecting music. And with time, especially, you build a network of friends. What was important to me as well is that, as you can see in the book, I don't have that many interviews, and especially that many recorded interviews. I work mainly with life histories, such as the history of Clomen that we see here, or my friend Whitnell. And it takes a long time to establish friendship and trust, and before we can talk about deeply personal issues. So mainly the people that I worked with are people that I know very well, people that I'm still in touch with, people that I'm still working with today. And it's not a big group of people. Of course, I talked with many, many people, state officials and so on and so forth. But for me, it was key to create those relationships, not only for the sake of research, but it's the strange thing about ethnography. You at some point, you don't know what is daily life and research. It blends. And I think that my friends knew about that as well. So it was always funny to, you're more or less like a spy at some times.
but what's nice is that the collaborative, sort of your collaborative ethos comes through really nicely in the book. And for full disclosure, I'm a very big fan and colleague of Laura Wagner's work and of her, you know, as a researcher and everything. So I'm really glad that you got to connect with her there. And I would love to speak with you more about Clomen towards the end, because she really starts begins to loom large at the end of the book. But I want to go back to the beginning and think about the way that you organized the book. So a lot of it, the book, it kind of circles around the earthquake, as so many things in Haiti do these days. You can't avoid talking about it. But you do begin with some processes that preceded it and are ongoing. And it seems like the issue of housing is one of these things that had a kind of ongoing history beforehand. And so you begin with these efforts at industrialization and make the argument that they were a disaster for the people of Haiti. So, can you tell us about that? How was the process of industrialization such a bad thing for ways of dwelling?
Yes. So, of course, the book is about dwelling and houses, but the book is also about domicile, meaning the systematic destruction of homes. And this is an ongoing process. So let me start with what is going on right now in the United States. A few months ago in Texas, we had those horrible images of immigration officers chasing Haitian immigrants at the border. And there is indeed a crisis of immigration in Haiti. People are emigrating right now at a fast pace because of the crisis. But one of the crises that is still ongoing today is the crisis of industrialization that leads to the displacement and to the destruction of people's homes, of people's farms, of people's livelihoods. To give you a quick example, it was in last February, Coca-Cola decided to run a stevia plantation in Haiti. They got in touch with a famous businessman from Haiti who helped them finding a place to open their stevia plantation. It's in Savandiane. And what happened as usual is that the land was grabbed from farmers who have been farming that land since at least 1986. A great deal of them also were women who were running a co-op. They grew peanuts. They were making nutritious food. And this is ongoing still in the whole country. So I'm talking about a famous U.S. corporation, but sometimes it can be also that a municipality will be the hospital. This was the case a few months ago in Terrier Rouge in northern Haiti, where the book starts in the Trou-du-Nord region. For building a hospital, the municipality grabbed 7,000 acres of land and displaced, once again, thousands of farmers. So this process has been happening before the earthquake, and I think increased after the earthquake because U.S. Special Envoy Bill Clinton and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton had that plan that they called Building Back Better, where the centerpiece was building economic growth by industrializing Haiti. So the book starts 200 miles away from the disaster-stricken region of Port-au-Prince in northern Haiti, in the Cape Haitian region, where a giant industrial park was built with some of the relief funds, some of the funds that were meant for the reconstruction of the country. And again, the building of this industrial park is to me a disaster. Not long ago, 2 months ago, the people who work in the factories of this industrial park demonstrated in the streets of Caracol because they are receiving very meager salaries. They work in terrible conditions. Plus, building that park in Caracol, which is a very fertile region, displaced 442 families of farmers. So we have that cycle that is happening again and again since the U.S. occupation of Haiti that started in 1915. And it feels as if the U.S. occupation of Haiti never ended, actually.
So housing is one of the ways through which you argue, and other people have argued as well, that there are no natural disasters. There are only political disasters, right? And you can really see that through the earthquake. So how was housing affected by the earthquake?
So about 75% of the built environment in the Port-au-Prince region was either flattened by the earthquake or permanently damaged. So if we think about Port-au-Prince, it's a city that was built for a population of about 100,000 people, and we have today maybe 3 to 4 million people living in the city of Port-au-Prince and its surrounding. So the city grew really, really fast, especially started in the 1970s, 1980s. People from the countryside started to flock to Port-au-Prince because this is where you found better jobs and where you had the possibility of sending your children to good high schools. This is where you had hospitals. So it's an extremely centralized country. All the services, the administration, the Port-au-Prince is the political and economic center of the country. And the earthquake reinforced the central position of Port-au-Prince, because most of the NGOs that flocked to Haiti after the earthquake settled shop in Port-au-Prince and offered sometimes free services in the city. So I think that this idea of centralization that started a long time ago during the colonial period, when France ruled over Haiti and decided to make Port-au-Prince the capital of the country, since then it has been a problem. If you think about Port-au-Prince, there was an earthquake in 1751, there was an earthquake in 1770, that flattened the city twice. It's not the first time that there are massive earthquakes in Port-au-Prince. We know that it is not a place that is suited for building residences, but nonetheless, this is the center of the country because of business interest. It's really the place where the north and the south of the country meet in the middle. Yes, the earthquake was not natural for several reasons. The disaster was not natural for several reasons. One, like I said, the centralization, the demographic centralization and the high density in Port-au-Prince led to this major disaster. There are too many people who live crowded in some of the neighborhoods in Port-au-Prince. And this is due once again to the centralization of service of everything that Haiti has to offer is in Port-au-Prince. This is why people would go there. The second thing too is that since 1994 and since the return of President Aristide, Bill Clinton at the time pushed for structural reforms that were devastating also for the Haitian state. So in 1994, 1995, we had what we call the Governor's Accord, which laid out neoliberal policies that led, for instance, of the firing of 50% of the state workforce. So the state literally dwindled in size. And all of a sudden, you do not have engineers or you do not have state workers who can make sure that construction codes are being respected. You do not have people who can work on urban planning, for instance. You have a meager police force that cannot enforce anything. So I think that the erosion of the state also in the 1990s contributed to really a sudden growth of Port-au-Prince and to a growth that was not really managed. So there are many elements that contributed to the earthquake. But all of these elements, besides the tremors themselves, none of it were natural. It was the result of political decisions, of political centralization mainly.
The book has a really interesting kind of arc, narrative arc, that I was just thinking about. You open with some, you know, stories of the ways that politics and economics really have devastated the ways of living of a lot of people. And then it gets a little bit more hopeful and a little bit more. You demonstrate also how people manage their circumstances and how they manage to thrive and how they manage to recreate their dwellings towards the end. We'll get to those. But one of the chapters that I found really really fascinating in such the detail in which you go, and you talk about this housing development in Kazimir, and it seems like they could not have done a worse job. In terms of the shape of the houses, how people were imagined to live there, the lack of infrastructures, et cetera. How did it end up that way? How was such a series of decisions made?
It's actually a very complex question. And I think that in a work of journalists like Jack Johnston or Jonathan Katz, for instance, we would find more answers that I brought in the book. It's a story of corruption. It's a story of mismanagement of funds. And this is also the illusion, once again, that industrialization should drive the reconstruction of Port-au-Prince. So by the way, the historian Claire Payton is working on those issues. How construction firms worked during the Duvalier period, for instance, hand in hand with the state, and how big construction project could be a way to launder money, pure and simple. So Kazimir is a neighborhood maybe 30 minutes north of Port-au-Prince. It's very isolated. It's in a desertic areas. You have cacti all over the place. It's a grid of small houses. There are some apartment buildings as well, all built with bad materials, with bad concrete. The houses are already falling into ruins today. And we have this grid of about 1,200 houses, and about 30% of them have never been finished. The project there, so the project was launched, I believe, in 2011. President Martelly at the time had funds to rebuild a very important neighborhood in downtown Port-au-Prince, the Fort Dimanche neighborhood. That money was meant to be used for that, to rebuild this central neighborhood of Port-au-Prince, but instead, the prime minister and the president diverted the funds and spent a great deal of money hiring a Dominican firm that belonged to a Dominican senator Felix Bautista, who overnight after the earthquake became a millionaire. He had no experience in construction, but he created two firms that built those projects. We have international funds that are used by the Haitian state. Those funds are funneled to a construction company from the Dominican Republic. And I guess that there was no master plan. I don't know where those plans came from, because it's hopefully maladapted to the surrounding environment. Thick concrete walls, low ceilings. One of my friends called them tifour, little ovens. It's so hot at the end of the day over there that you don't have a choice but to sit outside. But when you sit outside, it's full of mosquitoes. So it's really not a pleasant place. Plus, oddly enough, the plan was to have a factory coming there, but the factory never came. And for a number of years, up until 2015, 2016, you had many policemen who were patrolling that neighborhood, that little village, as they call it, and maintaining discipline, making sure that people were paying their rents, but also making sure that people could not cultivate, could not work in a garden, or did not plant trees, or did not do whatever they wanted with the house. They wanted to keep I call these houses, it's like a field of storage units. they wanted to keep it as it is. So it was really a strange setting. I believe that given the quality of the materials, that it was pretty cheap for the Dominican company to build those houses, but the Haitian state spent about $80 million on that project. But it doesn't match up with what we have on the ground. So I believe it's part of the diversion of about $2 billion of aid money, of aid funds by the party that is still in power today, by Martelly and his allies. But since I wrote this chapter, the end of the story of Kazemi is a little more hopeful too. Eventually, the police left. The Haitian administrators do not live there anymore, and it's like the Haitian state has abandoned Casimir, and people have taken over, and it's a much more lively place now. Trees are growing, people are cultivating gardens, they are building extra rooms on the roof of the houses, they are painting the houses as they see fit. It seems to have become a good place to live now. That's.
I'm glad to hear the end of that story. And that's not the only neighborhood that you talk about. One of the things that happens in the book is you start to get a sense of the very different kinds of settings. And in one chapter, you detail two neighborhoods which are very almost, well, they are next to each other, right? Martissan and Polos. And the contrast between them, as well as the role of the Haitian run NGO Focal, which I'm probably not pronouncing. Properly.
No, that's it. Focal, yes.
But so how does the contrast of these two neighborhoods, you talk about infrastructural citizenship, which I thought was a very compelling formulation. So how does putting those two neighborhoods against one another tell us about infrastructural citizenship and especially the role of this NGO?
Yes. So it was actually a difficult chapter to write because I'm not working with one of the informants that I'm talking about in this chapter, Evans. We had, let's say, a disagreement at some point of the fieldwork, and it was kind of strange. But I worked in his neighborhood and with him for quite a long time. And as I said in the book, I met him at an NGO camp base. He was working as a security over there. He was very bored with his job. And he wanted to show me where he was living, which was far away from his job. He wanted to show me that he could not afford to live in downtown Port-au-Prince, that he had no choice with the kind of salary that he had to live at the outskirts of the city. So Martissan and Bolos are at the southern tip of Port-au-Prince. And it's true that it's pretty far removed from the economic nerves of the city. Because, again, so many NGOs came in Port-au-Prince in 2010. People rented places in downtown Port-au-Prince. So it became, for many people, the rent prices went up and people had no choice but to settle in the neighborhoods that I talk about. So my friend Evans was living in Bolos and living actually in a pretty great neighborhood with good neighbors. It's a very pleasant neighborhood. It's located on a hill, so during the summer the wind blows. And what was very surprising there is that it is cut by a ravine, by a small ditch that is supposed to act as an open air sewage system, but it's completely clogged by trash. So he wanted to show me that, and he wanted me to pay attention to this problem because for him and his neighbor, the humid trash was bringing mosquitoes. Whenever you had a heavy rains, the ravine would overflow and the dirty water and the trash would get into houses, and that made the life of people living there absolutely miserable. And this is something that you see quite a lot in, you know, it's not unique to that neighborhood, to Bolos in Port-au-Prince. the social geography of Port-au-Prince is very peculiar. On the top of the hills, you have the richer people, and the trash of these people trickles down to the poorer, low-income neighborhoods that are located along the shore of the Bay of Port-au-Prince. So Bolos is such a neighborhood. It's not the only neighborhood that has this trash problem. But when you cross the street from Bolos 4th Avenue, there is a very important road. And under this road, there is most of the potable water that is distributed to Port-au-Prince is coming from under that road. It's a very important place in Port-au-Prince. It's called Route des Dalles. When you cross that street, you end up in a neighborhood of Martissant. And Martissant is completely different. It's radically different. So one of my best friends in Haiti, Winnell, lived there at the time when I met him in 2013. So I spent a lot of time in his house in Martissant, a lot of time with him. And he's a truck driver and a mechanic. At times, he's a chauffeur as well. So I drove along quite a lot with him. He showed me many places in that neighborhood. Martissant is peculiar because the Haitian NGO Focal, so the book is very critical of NGOs, of course, but I must say that Focal is quite unique. The president of Focal is former Prime Minister Michel Pierre-Louis. It's an organization that is mainly run by Haitian women and that is very, very efficient in many domains. It is more or less replacing the Minister of Culture, but not only, they do urban planning projects. So starting in 2007, 3 years before the earthquake, they managed to preserve a patch of forest in the middle of Port-au-Prince. And Martissant is like a beacon of light for the city because there is this magnificent park, the Martissant Park that is there. And in order to preserve the park and to make sure that people would not build houses over there, because in the park you have these important springs, you have the clean water that flows in the whole of Port-au-Prince, so it's very important to keep this place clean. In order for people to go along with the creation of the park, the Focal had the excellent idea to work with them to better their lives in their neighborhood and mainly to better the infrastructure of the neighborhood. The way it was made was very organic. There were popular committees created and people living there got together and set up the priorities such as building roads, building bridges, cleaning the ravines, and so on and so forth. But Focal did not take a top-down approach. The approach that they took is very peculiar for an NGO, unfortunately, but I think it's a good model. They connected the people living in Martissant with the state. So people worked directly with state agency for trash collection, for instance, with the state agency that is responsible for the DINEPA, for water, for electricity, and so on and so forth. And the result, 10 years after the project, are pretty amazing. Martissant is it's a decent neighborhood. It's a clean neighborhood with this magnificent park. There is a botanical garden. There is a public library over there, educational programs. It's a neighborhood that could function well. So I contrast those two neighborhoods to show, yes, this idea of infrastructural citizenship, meaning that belonging is really a matter of connection, not just social connections or institutional connections, like I talked about people getting in touch with state agencies, but just getting potable water in your house, the pipes and the wires that link us in one way or another are what I call a social and material infrastructure. I don't think that we can dissociate the two. And that's where, for the people that I interviewed in Martissant, especially my friends, Soraya and Winnell, This was transformative. It triggered in them, you know, political hopes. They were a lot more civically engaged in their neighborhood. They were very invested in all the projects that were happening. And that was a good feeling for them to see that their neighborhood was on the upswing. But in contrast, when you cross the Route des Dalles and you go to Bolos, you find the complete opposite. People feel completely abandoned by the state, but also by NGOs. And it's even more than that. They are in a state of abjection. They feel that they are actively disconnected from the grid of services and from institutions that they need to live on their own. They managed to get their ravine cleaned a couple of times, but since then the ravine we have the same exact problem. So showing this also, I show how piecemeal urban planning is creating new fractures in Port-au-Prince, new classes of first class, second class citizen in a way. The people who cannot have that connection, who cannot have basic public services such as trash collection, access to clean water, access to electricity. These people are, yes, disconnected from their citizenship.
Earlier on, you mentioned this idea of vernacular architectures, and in the book, you talk about two specific kinds of architectural styles: the gingerbread house and the shotgun house. And you also talk about how each of these styles is intrinsic and important to dwelling, not just to living, but to thriving. So can you talk about those a little bit?
Yes. So in the first place, I did field work in Port-au-Prince to study especially the gingerbread houses. After the earthquake, the thing that struck me is that the great majority of those houses, so we're talking about 400 Victorian mansions that were built between, I would say, you know, the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. A lot of them had a wood structure. They were bourgeois houses as well. Most of them, you know, belonged to upper middle class or to rich families of doctors, of lawyers, and so on and so forth. It was striking to see that these houses could sustain such a massive earthquake, and they sustained the earthquake pretty well. So some of the houses that I visited were damaged, but not to the point that you cannot repair them. They are built also with light materials. You know, it can be wood, steel roofs, those kinds of things. So when they collapse, usually they don't kill the people that are in them. So when I arrived to Haiti, I had the same feeling that I had in Natchez, Mississippi, where you have the big plantation houses or the rich people houses. And the gingerbread houses are very important in terms of cultural heritage for Haiti. And I praise again the NGO Focal for the efforts for preserving those houses. But like I said, like in Natchez, Mississippi, it was the smaller kind of gingerbread houses that you see all around Haiti, actually, that really piqued my interest. So I talk a lot about shotgun houses that are ubiquitous in the United States, in the South. They are usually depicted as African-American dwellings. You can see them in, for instance, in a city like New Orleans. Well, today in New Orleans, if you want to buy a shotgun houses, you need $400,000, $500,000. They went up in value, but the shotgun houses or smaller vernacular houses had the same features that you find on the gingerbread houses. So vernacular architecture is when you build with local materials and when you build also It's a form of architecture made by the locals. It's anonymous oftentimes, and it's really well adapted to the environmental and climatic conditions. What I found out while doing research, most people will tell you that the shotgun houses are a small size version of the gingerbread houses, but it's the contrary. The shotgun houses, you find them in Haiti already in the 18th century, and they would be the basis actually of the bigger Victorian mansions, the gingerbread houses that I'm talking about. So it's first and foremost a type of rural dwelling. That's the dwelling that you find in the countryside. And it's really well suited to the island. Like I said, it's built with light materials and with carpentry techniques that allows these houses to sustain earthquakes. Usually they have steep roofs for heavy rains. They are built on a platform, so there is no problems with floods. They have high ceilings and they have really neat ventilation systems. You don't need electricity to be in a cool house, and people figure that out. So you find those qualities in both the bourgeois houses, but also in the smaller rural version of them. And we need to remember that Port-au-Prince is mainly comprised of people who hail from the countryside, and the people of the countryside brought their vernacular architecture with them. It was well suited for a dense city as well, because shotgun houses are narrow. They have a front porch that enables also people to have a private public life. The porch of those shotgun houses is usually used for business activities. So looking at those houses, you find it's not only about the built environment and the fact that they are well adapted to the environment, but it's also a very good house, I would say, for the Haitian way of life. And most of the day is being spent under the galleries of those big houses or the front porch of those small houses in the semi-private space of the house. So it's a house where being outside of the walls and being surrounded by the shade is very important. Those are houses that are really well connected to one another in a way. They create a maze within Port-au-Prince, small little alleys that are quite convenient for people as well.
So we circle around to Clomène, finally, and she is a central figure in the last part of the book. And you use her, I think, or you her way of living really details the way that these houses and these dwellings create and strengthen relationships, and the ways that daily life and the space that's inhabited are so intrinsically and deeply related to one another. And you also talk about the role of gender and how that works as well. So how did you come to that realization? How did you make her realize that she was going to be the central part of the last part of the book?
That was evident from the get-go in a way. So I started to hang out at Clomène's house in 2013. She was a friend of my research partner of Alain Joseph. She had a house in downtown Port-au-Prince, and on the front side of her courtyard, she had tables and chairs, and you could go there. And drink a Coke or a Sprite or a beer in the shade of a tree, which is very convenient. Port-au-Prince is a very busy city. It's hard to find a place where you can sit down and write notes, or just, you know, sit down and being outside and being with people. So it's mainly happening in private spaces. But the front courtyard of Clomène, like I said, is a semi-private space. She would allow selected clientele, and I was lucky enough to be the friend of Alain, and she let me hang out over there. And over time, we talked a lot and we became friends. I first became friends with her sister, Monique, who was selling mangoes every day over there. So I had that ritual around 5 o'clock to go there to eat mangoes and to hang out with them and with my friends. And that's the way our friendship built up. I think it was around March 2014 that we learned about the rumors that her house would be destroyed. So it was a shotgun house. And that's also the reason that Alan brought me there, because it was a good hangout spot, but because also it was an interesting, it was interesting in terms of architecture. But in March, we learned that the whole area could be bulldozed by the state at any time. We didn't know when. We didn't know when it would happen. And my friend Clomen became very, very depressed and very worried, as anyone would be when you learn that the house where you spend more than 20 years of your life, where you were able to welcome your family after the earthquake, the people who lost their own houses. This house was cherished by the Firmin family. So when we learned that it could be demolished, it became urgent for Clomen. She wanted to tell her story, the story of her house, and why her house was so important to us and why it shouldn't be destroyed and why it was so stupid from the part of the state, and mainly how mean it was to destroy what was not just her residence, but like I detail in the book, it was also her business place. So we had two goals, actually, when we started to document her house and her life history. One of the goals was to raise funds so she could pack up her belongings and move to another place. So we managed to raise a little bit of funds by creating together a short biography and the story of her house. We did a GoFundMe and we got a few hundreds of dollars. And when her house was demolished in May 2014, with that money and with the help of friends, she was able to move to another house in Carrefour in southern Port-au-Prince, where she lives today. That was a tough period, March, April, until the destruction of her house in May. I spent quite a lot of time with her. Whenever she had time, she would sit down and, you know, we recorded several interviews. And again, she made the point of she really wanted to have her story told. One thing that I told her, it's a neighborhood, by the way, where you have the Faculté d'Ethnologie, so the anthropology department of the state university. People are well acquainted with ethnographers. They know what we do. And Clomen was not surprised with what I was doing, the type of documenting that I was doing. And I proposed to her to anonymize her in the book, but that's not something that she wanted. She wanted to have her name, the name of the people of her family and her story to be published. And it was important for her that her story would be told in English as well, because as many people in Haiti, she feels that the United States need to know what is going on in Haiti before they do any kind of interventions and before they support a state, a Haitian government that is destroying people's livelihoods. So that's when we really started to talk about her house and how she used it, how people in her family used it, how it was not just a house or just a place where she slept, but it was a place where she was conducting business as well. It was in the middle of the city. It was also convenient for her because Clomen has three children. And at the time, Kira, her youngest daughter, was 8 years old. She was going to school, so working from home and working with family members in and around her house gave Clomen some flexibility. And that was very important. She could walk her daughter to school. She could pick her up. She could have a family life and a business life at the same time. This is why domestic economies or female economies are so important. Usually they are not considered as being part of the formal economy, but in Haiti, it's working from home and building businesses from domestic spheres is a way for women who engage in those small businesses to gain autonomy, financial autonomy, but also flexibility with their time. And since 1994 up to 2014, Clomen lived in complete independence and autonomy. She was very proud of the fact that she never asked anything from an NGO, from the state, that she was able to generate her own income. So did her husband, who worked downtown, and her brothers and sisters as well. So the house was very important because it was a family center, the center for the family. It was a place where you conduct business. And when you conduct those types of small businesses, you make very little money. But what is important is that you engage in meaningful social relationships, that you are creating a solidarity network. And that's what Clomen talks about. It's not just a house, but also to be in the neighborhood with people that she has known for a long time. As she said, when she moved to that little town, to Carrefour, her main concern is that in Carrefour, if anything is happening to her, if she doesn't have food, like she said, she would go hungry. Whereas in her in Monatuf, the neighborhood where she lived, this would never happen to her. People would take care of her, would take care of her family, and she was able to take care also of her people over there. So that's what was lost when that neighborhood was demolished. It was not just shelters once again that were demolished, but dwellings and a very important network of social relationships and networks of solidarity.
You've been very generous with your time. I have one last question before I let you go. I'm wondering how the experience of researching and writing the book has changed your, if it's changed your approach to scholarship, and how has that sort of affected your, what you're working on at the moment?
It was a long-term project, of course, that started before I did fieldwork in 2012. So it took about 10 years. I think it reinforced my belief that cultural anthropology and ethnography should be collaborative in nature. Something that is, I guess, perhaps peculiar with my book is that I have very long excerpts of recorded interviews. Usually you have tidbits or you have small paragraphs here and there, but that's something that I would like to do more to give space in our ethnographies, more space for people to explain themselves. So first and foremost, I think it really reinforced my belief that ethnography is a collaborative activity, I would say.
That's a great place to end. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Well, thank you for your time.